Well, welcome everybody to first one of our Library Environmental Committee series this year. We plan to have maybe one more late spring, so maybe May. I don't know. We haven't planned it out exactly yet. But anyway, today we're pleased to welcome Dr. Frank Tolewski, professor of plant biology and curator of the W.J. Beal Botanical Garden and Campus Arboretum. And his research is in the area of the ecophysiology of woody plants. So, welcome, Frank.
Thank you very much.
His talk is Keeping MSU Green, Replenishing the Campus Arboretum.
Well, thank you for all coming this afternoon. It's always a pleasure to talk about trees here at Michigan State. We have a great history of trees. And this afternoon, I think in the first couple slides here, through the courtesy of Mr. Peabody, also known as MSU Archives, we're going to set the Wayback Machine 170 years. And so when we look out on campus, we look out the window today. Of course, the leaves are not on the trees. This is basically what we would see. But once we fire up the Wayback, there we are. We are now 170 years ago. And this is College Hall, which stood where Beaumont Tower stands today. And there's our campus arboretum. Okay. Not really. There's our campus arboretum. Okay. And what I need to do actually is to figure out exactly what exposure. Is this the south side and this the east side? Is this the north side and this is the west side? I'm sure we can probably figure that out and get someone's input on that. But it would be neat if I'm hoping this is the north side, because it'll be neat to see if some of these trees are in fact identifiable as some of the mature old trees we have on campus. And so some of you probably know or remember from this past summer, unfortunately in July when we had that really severe thunderstorm come through, we lost that big oak tree over by Lytton Hall. But because of that, we were actually able to find out that we have a tree 347 years old. And I was just checking out on a web page that has the oldest trees recorded, and the oldest white oak tree that's recorded on that page is nowhere near 347 years old. So we will have to get the MSU campus on that list of oldest white oak trees, because that oak tree is still alive. There's not much left of it, but if you go up to Lytton Hall, you'll see what's left of the trunk and one branch, and we're hoping we might get some acorns off of that, but we'll talk about that more. But coming back to the subject material of the talk this afternoon, when you look at campus the way it was 160 years ago, 160 years ago, basically, we were a wilderness, we were a woodland, and they were clearing the land to build buildings and build the campus. A few trees were left, but certainly when we look around campus today, we see a lot of trees. And so really the great majority of trees that we have on campus today were planted subsequent to the development of campus. And the tradition of planting trees on campus really started rather quickly, almost immediately after the campus was being developed. And so we kind of look at a couple of different periods of time. I kind of broke them up just real quickly, maybe not so conveniently. But if we think about the periods from the founding of the campus up to 1869, there were several people, J.C. Holmes, George Thurber, and Albert Prentice, all professors involved with horticulture and botany. And we're all involved in some aspect of actually planting some of the very first trees on campus. And then Professor Beal arrived in 1870 and served on campus until 1910 before he retired. And Professor Beal planted a number of trees on campus, as did Professor Bogue, who was the first professor of forestry here at Michigan State. Once Professor Beal, who was also professor of forestry, had the forestry department break off and form its own separate department in 1902. So, these periods of time, we've got really pretty good documentation for what trees were planted on campus, and in large part because of Professor Beal. And if you haven't read it and you claim to believe green, then I highly recommend that you take Professor Beal's book home and start reading it that he published in 1950. There's some excellent, excellent information there about this campus and the people who served on this campus up until that time. We kind of go into the dark ages, theoretically speaking, in terms of MSU's plant records, and that's after Professor Beal retired up to the pre-President Hanna period of time. There were a number of things that happened here. We don't have a lot of good record keeping. One thing that I do know is that we did have a memorial tree, a commemorative tree planted by President, oh, holy. Nope, no, United States President. Roosevelt, thank you. Teddy Roosevelt, not the, so Roosevelt came to campus, and I think it was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Memorial Act. And so since we are the first land-grant institution, although we kind of argue that with Penn State, but we did get it a few days before Penn State, a few weeks before Penn State. So we are the founding land-grant institution. President Roosevelt came here and planted what was called the Roosevelt Elm, which is actually is planted up here near where Williams Hall is. There used to be the original president's house. It's right on that corner between the Beale entrance and where West Circle Drive comes in. And when they started tearing all those what we call faculty row down, they tried to actually physically move that tree. It's the first time in MSU history that we tried to move a mature tree. We actually dug the tree and slid it across the street into what's called Abbott Field. And it grew there for a few years, but it didn't do very well and eventually declined and died. But anyway, kind of, you know, commitment towards keeping the campus green and important trees. We have a long heritage of trying to keep people from cutting trees down on this campus. Sometimes, most of the times we succeed. Once in a while we don't. I won't go into details. Okay, so anyway, in 1941, President Hanna came to campus, and John Hanna came to campus, became the president. In about 1945, he created a division called Campus Park and Planning, which was unique in the history of Michigan State University and unique in the history of academic institutions, not only in the United States, but around the world. And that actually gave the campus itself, what Hanna used to refer to as the campus park, a priority in terms of maintenance and attention. And so the landscape architects in the grounds department and the Beale Botanical Garden were all under the auspices of Campus Park and Planning, so the planning office. When Hanna retired in 1969, but before Hanna retired, back in the early 40s, again 1946, he appointed Milt Barron, and Milt Barron served as the director of Campus Park and Planning until 1981. Milt Barron was an incredible plantsman, very active. He was a Harvard graduate, a landscape architect by training, held a faculty position in landscape architecture, and is responsible for introducing a number of new varieties of plants to the industry, in addition to his day job. So he was quite a remarkable person. I had the opportunity to get to know Milt after he retired. He passed away just a year or two ago now, at the ripe age of, I think it was 101, I think he made. So talk about putting on growth rings. That was pretty remarkable. And he was a remarkable man right to the end, and his memory never failed. I wish that for everybody, myself included, if we could be so lucky. But anyway, then basically 1982 up until present, kind of the post-Barron years, a number of things happened there. Campus Park and Planning was dissolved into Campus Planning Administration. Campus Planning Administration was absorbed with the reorganization of physical plant into IPF. So all of our landscape architects, our campus planner, and the grounds department, which is now called Landscape Services, are all located within IPF. But we have good records, actually, really good records. We've got pretty good records here from the Milt Barron era. Fortunately, Milt Barron and his staff at Beaumont Nursery kept pretty good records. We have a lot of paper records. We're trying to integrate those paper records into our digital records. Unfortunately, they never quite made it, but we do have cards and paper files. We are able to document what trees, you know, some of the trees on campus, where they came from. And then actually starting in 1988, we began having a computer digitized database for our trees. And so really from 1988 on, the collections database and our record keeping gets really excellent. And so we continue that tradition today with both mapping and inventory of campus trees. But with that, the first trees planted on campus, we can go all the way back to 1858, and we can actually find out that Professor Holmes planted Norway spruce, white pine, Austrian pine, Scots pine, and red cedar here on the campus. And George Thurber, who was professor of botany here from 1860 to 1863, had a large hand in getting some interesting plants planted on campus. This is the Taxodium. If you look out the window, you can see that Taxodium disticum, the Ginkgo biloba, and these Picea abies. There were 350 Picea abies planted on the campus in 1863. including several at around Beaumont Tower today when it was College Hall. The interesting thing is that Professor Thurber was very well known in the botanical community at the time and was well integrated with a number of scholars in botany, and also was involved and knew personally Professor Asa Gray at Harvard. And Professor Asa Gray at Harvard sent this ginkgo tree to Professor Thurber to plant on the campus of MSU. And at the time that this tree was planted on the campus of MSU, William James Beale was a student of Asa Gray's at Harvard. So we have some pretty good root connections to Harvard, both figuratively and literally, in terms of our plant collections. So George Thurber planted the ginkgo, planted the bald cypress, oriental spruce, Sumbra pine, Serbian pea tree, privet, Kentucky coffee tree, and Japanese quince. Of these, I know this one. I know this one. I think I know this one. It might be the one that's just on the east side of the MSU Museum. There's a very old oriental spruce right there. Sumbra pine, I'm not sure that still existed. Probably not. Maybe as offspring, as invasive species. Probably we have some Kentucky coffee trees, and I know there's some up around Beaumont Tower. Very good possibility that might be one that he planted. And again, the quince, probably not. But again, here's kind of a picture of today. There's our bald cypress, and there's our ginkgo tree from Harvard University right there. And there's one of our 1863 Norway spruces. So kind of take a quick look at some trees. These are just some trees that were planted early on campus. This is, of course, Cole's house, President's house. This is what was Faculty Row. Campbell Hall's over here. Gilchrist Yakeley's over here now. You can see a lot of spruce trees growing at that time. We can go and use the Wayback Machine and come back to the present day. And lo and behold, there are the two spruce trees over by Cole's house, and there's one of the spruce trees over here on the south end of Campbell Hall. There's a Austrian pine right here. I wonder if that Austrian pine isn't one of the old Austrian pines. We'd have to take a core from it to find out. We did have an Austrian pine over by the MSU Museum, which did date back into the 1870s. So we do have some of those old trees still on campus. We have to be careful with them. They are susceptible to diplodia, and our arborist crew, I see partially represented in the back here, is very helpful in making sure that those trees stay healthy so we can hold on to them. Again, if we look at some of those old spruces, this is a very early picture of the botanical garden. See the two spruces right there. And there they are in a postcard. And there they are again in another postcard. And there they are today. And if you look right outside the window, they're right there. So really wonderful to be able to do some photo reconstructions of campus and find trees. And we can do that with all kinds of places. Beale Botanical Garden shed now resides right over here. This is the old log cabin shed. There's William James himself. The original pond with a muddy basin rather than a concrete basin. And there it is today. And so you can see the shed's been moved. There's the pond. And there's the tree right there, the Norway spruce. Think? Trying to do a little. So Wayback Machine's functioning here. Malfunction the Wayback Machine. Ah! Okay. And here's that tree again. So from a different angle. And there's the tree again. I'm not sure what this building is right here. It's just kind of in the way. One of the traditions that was started very early on campus in terms of making sure we keep green was the idea of commemorative trees. And this is the earliest known commemorative tree on campus. It was planted by MAC, Michigan State University President Abbott, on the birth of his daughter, who was born on January 10th of 1863. I don't know that he actually planted it on January 10th. I'm sure the ground was frozen. So, but later on, he actually, written in Professor Beale's book, which is really wonderful, he actually describes how President Abbott went down to a stand of white pine growing along the Red Cedar River here on campus and dug up a seedling and planted it right there. So this is a native tree to campus. This is one of our heritage trees. It's not only a white pine planted as a commemorative tree, but it is an original genetic-based tree, original gene pool for this part of Michigan for white pine, which makes it very, very important. I don't know how many of those documented we have now, because so many white pine have been introduced to the area and replanted. But the thing that's always kind of fun is that his daughter actually got married under that tree in 1883. So very strong connections to the campus. And that tradition of planting commemorative trees continues. Harold Lautner was actually the first director of campus park and planning. Here's his commemorative tree right in the shadow of Beaumont Tower. This is a Liriodendron tulipifera, a tulip tree. And if you look outside, it's right there.
So, and then we have another tree. This is the tree right here. Interesting, this is up by Beaumont Tower as well. We have trees, commemorative trees all over campus. We have about, what, Jeff, 200 trees? About 200 commemorative trees on campus. Steve Troost, who's a campus planter over in IPF, is the contact person for planting commemorative trees. This is a sugar maple. It's really interesting. If you want to see some interesting biology in action, go out and take a look at it. There's little nip marks from the squirrels, and the squirrels have come up and just a little bit of their teeth, just tip of teeth, just nick the bark just a little bit so it bleeds out, and then they go up there and they have maple sap. So who said squirrels weren't smart? When they start wanting internet access, we have to be careful. Really? Acorn pancakes, right? There you go. Oh, gosh, the squirrels are coming. The squirrels are coming. Professor Beals, you mentioned before, did a lot of planting, and his major contribution to planting trees on campus actually started in the fall of 1874 when he created the Beal Arboretum up on North Campus. And he started it out by actually planting two rows of swamp white oaks that he collected from acorns from the original swamp white oaks. And there's one of the original swamp white oaks. So when we think about keeping the MSU campus green, it's not just the fact that we plant new trees and shrubs on campus, but we also go through a great deal of pain to conserve the trees that we have on campus and protect those trees on campus. And again, the Arbor's crew under Paul Schwartz's direction, very important in putting up those plastic protection areas around trees during construction so people don't park under trees. We have that no parking, please save our trees posters that we put up during football games. When I first came here and started working with Paul Schwartz, they were parking over the oval up here. And once you park a few times on soil, you can actually change that soil density to what you basically have in concrete in terms of what we call bulk density. And roots do not like to grow through concrete, okay? They don't. And so we really emphasize with our DPS department, campus police, that, look, we can't park cars here. We're going to kill our trees. And when we have 300-plus-year-old trees, not to mention the trees planted since and historically important trees, why are we parking under them? So we've been fairly successful. We have some of the breakout issues elsewhere on campus, but at least they're not parking on the oval anymore. But anyway, so here's again some of the swamp white oaks. There they are, Quercus bicolor, Quercus bicolor. Look at how close they are to the foundation of the building. So when this building was built in the 1930s, I mean, great effort was taken by the architects and by the construction companies not to damage these trees. These trees could be 300 years old. They could be 400 years old. I used to say, how old do you think they are? Well, I know they're definitely older than 150 because the trees that were planted when Beal planted the Arboretum, maybe 200. You know, when we got that 347-year-old tree, and that 347 years old, by the way, is 20 feet up the trunk where the trunk was solid, who knows how old these trees are? Okay? And I'm not going to sit there and bore one if I don't have to. I mean, you know, I don't want to risk the possibility of you know, getting the tree with an internal rot. Usually that doesn't happen, but it's a risk. And if it's, you know, it's unnecessary, why do it? So anyway, here's the Arboretum. You can see the swamp white oaks right there. So these are the kids, those are the offspring of these trees right here and there. That's kind of cool. The Arboretum, as you'll find out, also kind of started out as the first campus nursery because Professor Beal would grow trees up in here. He actually planted them on 4-foot centers. Okay. People didn't know how to grow trees back in the 1870s. How do you grow a tree? I don't know. I'll put it in the ground. Okay. How far should we space them apart? Oh, 4 foot looks good. Oops. Okay. And you can actually see these trees on 4-foot centers. We lost a lot of them in between through the years as the stand thinned out. Then here's a row, here's a row. Then there's three missing rows right here that used to be white ash trees. And then here's the sugar maples that were in rows over here. But Bishop Beal would actually take the trees, dig them out, and plant them elsewhere on campus from the Arboretum. It's actually contained in his notes. So Professor Bogue and Professor Beal got together shortly after Professor Bogue came to campus. Professor Beal realized that the pressure for construction on campus was fairly great and that eventually his little plot of land up here was going to probably be converted into a building site. And so he convinced Professor Bogue and Professor Bogue was agreed 100%. Well, why don't we start planting an arboretum just south of the river because they're never going to expand south of the river. And so Bogue planted what he referred to as the Bogue Arboretum. And actually, that's all of these trees that we see. Wells Hall is off here to the right. Okay, the International Center is back behind these trees, and Erickson Kiever is over here. But we see these trees planted in rows on 4-foot centers. Yay! Okay, these are all trees that were planted starting about 1902 by Professor Bogue and Professor Beal. And so we got some very interesting trees there. And again, you just got to watch out for those squirrels. You know, you're going to start seeing him with a little iPhone there. Can I get nuts to go, please? All right, Glenn Phillips, architect, T. Glenn Phillips, very important in really setting the tone, preserving the tone of the flavor of the MSU campus, starting in 1925, hired by the president at the time to work on things, and set up the whole concept of the plan layout, this original campus planning, if you will, for the university. And basically, the philosophy since Beal's time has always been, or even before Beal's time, is plants to the unusual. Let's get increase in diversity of plant collections for teaching and research, not just for beauty. So when I always refer to the campus, it's you know, it's more than just a pretty place. Okay, it's a working arboretum both for teaching and research and outreach. So all three major mission components of Michigan State University or any educational institution. And again, we see that, you know, we work with other botanical gardens in an arboreta. Certainly Harvard, one of the first ones we worked with. Professor Beal, when he came here, kept a very good working relationship with the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard up in Boston, the USDA, and a number of other institutions, both within the United States and internationally. And we can continue that tradition on today with our International Seed Exchange Program. We supply a seed catalog to almost 500 institutions nationally and globally. And right now we're in the full swing of our seed exchange program. We're getting a lot of seed orders for material that we offer, and we get a lot of seeds from them that we then grow up at MSU to plant in the Beal Botanical Garden and also across campus. Milt Barron, as I mentioned before, was an incredible person. He served as the director of campus park and planning for a short period of time from 51 to 1955, when I was born. Kind of put some perspective in there for the Wayback Machine. He served as curator, and he was responsible for redesigning the garden as we know it today. So when we see how that, all those beds are laid out, that's really Milt Barron's work. But here's just some of the plants that he introduced in the day, 72, 75, 81, 83, 89. Of course, sugar thyme, Malus sugar thyme is probably his best known and most popular cultivar. We have a number of them growing on campus, and it's a fairly popular seller within the nursery industry. The Dawn Redwood, we received this, planted in 1954 down in the Beal Botanical Garden. This came from the Arnold Arboretum. Again, it doesn't have to be old, although 62 years is starting to feel old, 61 years. This tree is from the original seed collection that the Arnold Arboretum had obtained when they went on that exploration to China, when they confirmed the existence of this, what we now call a living fossil, Metasequoia, where it was that little refugee of population, that little isolated population, was still growing in the mountains in northern China, and sent those seeds back to the Arnold, and they germinated them and distributed them to botanic gardens around the world, and we received ours. They sent us seeds early on in the 1940s that were apparently sent to the botany department, and nobody knows what happened to them. And so Milt Barron had contacted the director at the Arnold Arboretum. Again, Milt Barron, being a graduate of Harvard University, had a good contact there, and they actually sent us a sapling. And so that was what we planted in the garden. Very proud to have that tree. It's over 100 feet tall. It was struck by lightning. We have put a lightning arrestor in there, and hopefully it'll be okay. It's been doing okay for the last several years. James Hanover is a professor in forestry, did a lot of crossbreeding of trees, working with the Christmas tree industry. We have two of his creations on campus, the Spartan spruce here, which are, these two trees are right in front of Cole's house, up on that northeast corner of Cole's house across the driveway. The American spruce, a red, white, and blue spruce, which is a cross between white spruce, blue spruce, and red spruce, hence red, white, and blue spruce, the bicentennial spruce. We have a commemorative tree that's planted over by the forestry department right there on the corner of Wilson and Farm Lane at the Natural Resources Department. So again, we have a very robust history of plant work here at MSU, and particularly with regard to trees. So kind of go over a little bit of what I like to call the cradle to grave, or maybe more euphemistically, seed to carbon sequestration. What the program is we actually have here on campus and how we do things. So it's a sustainable philosophy for keeping the MSU campus green. And first thing we want to talk about is the cradles Where did we grow our plant material? So if we don't buy our material from a nursery off campus, or we don't get a plant, like from the Arnold Arboretum donated, where do we get our plants from? Well, we've been growing our plants on this campus, well, since Professor Beal's time, and then planting them out onto campus. So really, the Beal Arboretum turns out to be our very first campus nursery. There may have been a nursery between the Beal Nursery, the Beal Arboretum, and the Lilac Street, but I haven't found evidence of it. There is a nursery out at the end of Lilac Street, you know, over in the Flower Pot District here west of campus. And it's right up on the south end of the Red Cedar Natural Area. As a matter of fact, about 10, 15 years ago, the Campus Natural Areas Committee voted to include the old campus nursery as part of the Red Cedar Natural Area. The Red Cedar Natural Area is a Category 1 natural area because it's still pretty untouched. But this area was kind of disturbed, so it's kind of a Category 3 portion of the Red Cedar. There's some garden plots that are out there. So those of you who might be familiar with the MSU garden plots, they're out there. Then the nursery was moved to Service Road, which is now the C.E. Lewis Planting Arboretum, between Bogue Street and Farm Lane, south of the railroad tracks. And there's evidence, oh, you know what? Darn, I have a slide of that, and I forgot to put it in here. But anyway, and then, of course, today, for the last several decades, probably at least the last 50 years, if not more, Beaumont Nursery has been our campus nursery, established campus nursery, just off of Beaumont Road down on South Campus, across from what I like to call the world's largest barbecue, or our agriculture animal incinerator facility. So in case you get bovine TB or mad cow disease or, you know, deer come down with whatever disease, you know, that's where they kind of get rid of their remains. But anyway, where are those all located? So here up on North Campus, there's the Beal Arboretum, still intact. I think Professor Beal would be absolutely amazed since he kind of figured that would be built up and removed. Here's the Lilac Street Nursery. You see that little spot right there, That's the garden plots. But if you walk back, if you take that road back and you walk back, you'll actually see there's some old English oaks back there and some plants planted in rows. Just a little bit of stuff left there. Then focus return to Service Road. So this whole area here at one time was the nursery. In the early 1960s, this portion of the nursery was actually turned into a shrub garden with an extensive and diverse collection of plant material. It's kind of sad. We've had a rather extensive collections of plant material during Milt Barron and George Parmley's time on campus that we've lost. I mean, we had extensive collections of shrubs here. We had an extensive lilac collection, which used to be up around what's now the Business College. We had an extensive collection of clematis that were planted along up here by the baseball field. We had an extensive collection of crab apples, which I'll talk about in a number of areas, but very notoriously along Kalamazoo Street, very diverse collection of crab apples. And sadly, over time, for a number of reasons, I'm sure things have not been maintained at that level. We do try to the best we can. Anyway, Service Road Nursery, if you go out here in this little parking lot right here, you actually look at these trees. There's some spruce trees and some maple trees. They're actually in rows. Those are original planting block rows from Beaumont, from that nursery operation. And then eventually operations were moved out here to Beaumont Nursery. And so here we can see all the planting blocks today. There's our south blocks. We have hoop houses. We have the greenhouse facility and headhouse facility and some planting blocks just north of there. So this is the Toomey Woodlot. That's Baker Woodlot, Sanford Woodlot, and of course the Red Cedar Woodlot. So if you drive out heading south on Beaumont Road and you see all of these houses and stuff out here, that's not part of the agriculture experiment station. That's not part of plant biology or horticulture. This is Landscape Services, IPF's Beaumont Nursery. And there's the glass house. Here's some of the hoop houses. This is one of the conifer blocks. And so there it is. As you can see, University Landscape Services, Beaumont Nursery. And we look at it, basically a lot of propagation goes here. So Jay Andrews, who is manages the operation out there, he likes to say he doesn't manage it. He manages it. Giving credit where credit's due. But anyway, basically, we get him seed. He gets seed. He collects his own seed. I collect seed with him and propagates it. Here we can see some oak trees from campus that we got starting to germinate out of the nursery. This picture was just taken on Monday. So they're doing quite happy there in the greenhouses there. We have these hoop houses. A lot of these hoop houses are for overwintering plants that are in containers and grown up in containers. And here we can see what the inside of one of those hoop houses looks like, again, as of Monday. We have some nice witch hazels over here, some other plants. So they're in their dormant state right now. Here we see a cutting facility. So Jay Andrews goes out on campus or down to Hidden Lake Garden or elsewhere, and he'll collect cuttings and then put the cuttings into propagation, start getting these to root, and then we can propagate them up. And then the staff helps Jay pot up the plants. Here we see they're moving the containers up to a larger size. And we also have facilities for storage of seeds and cuttings. So when we get seed in, it needs to be kept cold. If it needs to be stratified, some seed needs to be pre-treated with regard to temperature conditions and moisture conditions before they'll germinate. So we got to kind of, you know, make the seed think it went through a winter. Some seeds are incredibly recalcitrant, and Jay is a master at understanding this. A seed may need to go through a winter cold period, a summer warm period, followed by another winter cold period, followed by another summer warm period before it'll germinate. And you know, if you don't know which species do that, if you just plant the seed in the ground and it doesn't germinate, you think, oh, well, it wasn't, you know, no, that may not be the problem at all. It may be something about its dormancy that needs to be broken. So it takes a really knowledgeable person to be able to do that. Then once the plants are grown up to size, we usually put them out into blocks. Here we see our deciduous tree blocks. That's the woodlot back there, Toomey Woodlot. Beaumont Road in the background here, campus, there's the power plant, of course. This is our one of our conifer blocks. And then we grow them up to size. Why do we grow them up to size? Well, because unfortunately, we are a university. Fortunately, we are a university, excuse me. And we have very, very active students who occasionally go out on a Friday night or a Saturday night. And, well, we're all studying on Fridays and Saturdays night. And after a long night of studying, they get a little rambunctious and they come back to campus. And especially if there was a football game or a basketball game that we won, they might want to sit there and start snapping trees off and making a bonfire with a couch, you know, or just because they feel that they need to take some frustration out, they'll snap a tree off, and gee, isn't that wonderful? Well, the larger the diameter of the tree, the less probability it's going to be snapped off. And so we usually have a standard of planting a tree of about 2 inches in caliber on campus so it has a chance to survive. From a horticultural standpoint, the smaller the tree is, the better chance it has to establish its own roots and actually grow faster. But we have to find that happy medium between being a very active campus and getting good growth on our trees. But again, so a lot of these trees, some of these Jay Andrews buys in as whips from nurseries around the country, usually out in the Pacific Northwest, and grows them up to size. Those would be most of our named cultivar varieties, so like October Glory or Red Sunset. And then some of these trees out here are actually trees that I collected from seed or Jay collected from seed, or we got through the International Seed Exchange, known wild populations and so forth. Same thing for the conifers. And campus planting in Shaw Lane. So we think about, you know, once we get the nursery trees grown up at the nursery, we want to start putting them on campus. For those of you who've been here as long as I have, and I know some of you have been here longer, and if you go down to Shaw Lane, east of Bogue Street, going to Hagedorn, you may remember that that used to be a bunch of little red maples down there. And I remember when I came to campus, and those red maples were smaller than these trees in these photographs. And I was talking to Paul Schwartz, and he said, well, yeah, these trees were planted back in like the, you know, the 1950s. You got to be kidding me. And you take a look at the growth, and it, you know, those trees are putting on maybe that much growth every year. So it's great bonsai, you know. But we don't want bonsai red maples along our roads. We want to have big, healthy, happy trees. So after the law school was moved to the Michigan State University campus, we received funding to literally rip out all of the soil in the medians and replace that soil with a special soil mix, which had a combination of organic matter and gravel, sandy matter, so it's a really good draining soil, but it's got good aeration, so good root growth. And these trees were planted in about 1999, 1998. And so we can see we've got wonderful oak trees. Look at these oak trees, they're gorgeous. We have red maples, and we have, these are a hybrid maple, Acer freemanii, which is a hybrid between silver maple and red maple. They're just taking off. I'm just gonna be a beautiful, you know, it's gonna be a beautiful allay of trees, as the landscape architects like to say, in a few more years. It's actually very nice now. These trees are probably twice as tall in the last 20 years that they were planted, roughly, if you think about less than 20 years, than those red maples were when I came to campus in the early 1990s. Soil can make a huge amount of difference for a happy tree. And that's one thing that we try to know about. Trowbridge Road Extension, as you know, Trowbridge Road came in. There's two things happening out in Trowbridge Road. One of the things that I was briefed on was the desire to have a conifer planting to put a visual and sound barrier between the railroad tracks and the dormitories there on South Campus and Trowbridge Road. And so the plan was, we're just going to plant a whole bunch of eastern white pine. And I said, well, here's an opportunity. Why don't we try doing something different and plant a collection of conifers that we know will grow in Michigan, but represent the diversity of North America. And if we start on the east side and we plant East Coast species and we work our way across to the west end and plant West Coast species, we could have a walk across America. And so that's the name stuck. And so we actually have what we call the walk across America. And so here we see some ponderosa pines here on the western end. Here we see some red cedars about midway. This is what it looks like when you're driving down the road. I was driving down. Shh, quick, take a picture. Not supposed to do that, but I did. Bad Frank. Here we see some of the spruces and white pine here on the eastern side, power plant in the back there. Eventually, we do have plans for a meandering wood chip path to go through here, and we want to put some interpretive signage in there as well. So, of course, I was taking these pictures last week, and the campus was completely frozen over. So here we see more Trowbridge Road. And again, these are nice trees that are coming along. This is the median, so here's the westbound lane, and I'm in the parking lot of the visitor center. The eastbound lane is over here. A good variety of deciduous trees and flowering trees, crab apples and so forth. And really, they're doing quite well. Some not so well, but I think the majority of them are doing quite well growing. So again, very important to keep planting trees. Nothing lasts forever. And when it comes up to nothing lasts forever, this was kind of one of our most controversial, unfortunately, shouldn't have been controversial, but it was, decisions that we made in terms of reinvigorating landscape. The Abbott Road entrance, you may remember, was kind of had those, nice, shady trees, and it was really kind of neat. Well, but if you're the campus arborist or tree crew and you have to take care of these things, or if you're the curator of woody plants, the campus arboretum, and you understand, hazard trees along with everybody else in the tree crew. These old Norway maples, which were planted probably in the 1930s, posed two major problems for us. First of all, Norway maple's an invasive species now. We didn't know that when we planted it. It's a good street tree. It's a good urban tree. It does well. One of the problems with Norway maples, however, though, is that when you plant them, they have girdling root issues, which lead to their decline. These trees were getting beyond their prime. There were columns of decay. There were a number of canopy branches that were broken off. And that's a very highly trafficked area. From the standpoint of hazard trees, we call that a high impact zone, high target zone. You have high quality targets, students, faculties, visitors, cars, you name it. We don't want anybody getting hurt. So after a long period of time, we decided we need to sit there and finally we got to bite the bullet. And Paul had been taking them out, the tree crew had been taking them out, one here, one there, two here, over decades. It was really declining. And so we committed some funds to the project. We totally redid the project. And, to some people it looks like hell. Yeah, they're young trees. I mean, they're going to get big. What do you think the Norway maples looked like when they were planted back in the 1930s? I mean, you got to start somewhere, right? So we decided we're going to plant the Quercus bicolor swamp white oaks, which are a native tree to Michigan, so we don't have the invasive problem. They should be good street trees. You see a really nice tree here. Okay, so we had to cut down all those trees. Well, we tried to do press releases. We contacted the media. We had interviews. And we still got really vehement emails and letters, from alumni and employees and students about, what did you do? It looks terrible. I'm sorry. Yeah, we didn't do this because we wanted to do. We did it because we had to. Some landscapes need revision. We take protecting trees, what trees we have on campus, with a great deal of pride. Ask the four fellows sitting in the back of the room right here. in terms of injecting trees, pruning trees, spraying trees, coming in at all hours of the morning, okay, to ensure that the trees that we have, and especially those like the Plodia on red pine, on Austrian pine, or Dutch elm disease, or two-line chestnut borer, or emerald ash borer, we got a lot of issues that if it wasn't for having a qualified tree crew, we wouldn't have a lot of these trees on campus. We take our trees seriously. We don't just cut them down because we want to cut down trees, all right? And so that's, you know, we take a lot of pride in that. Special programs that we have that are associated with trees. I talked about the commemorative tree program already, and I was just wrapping things up here. We're going to talk a little bit about the heritage tree program, our crab apple conservation program, and then finally, you know, the grave side of things, our MSU Shadows program, which we just got approved, and so some of you are probably aware of that, working through the folks at the MSU surplus store. But the Heritage Tree Program started back in the 1990s when Tim Bolin was still here. I talked to Tim Bolin and said, hey, you know, we got all of these oak trees that predate the campus. They're the original genetic stock of the campus. Wouldn't it be neat if we could actually collect acorns or collect seeds from these original trees? And then maybe some of the early trees that were planted early on, and keep that circulating, keep it going on campus. And so he agreed, and we started the program. Got off to a little bumpy start. Jay Andrews, I said, now is out at the nursery. You know, you can read that, Quercus bicolor. It says heritage tree right there. That's not a cultivar name. It's just identifying that these trees are part of the heritage tree program. Just a couple of weeks ago, we got approval from President Simon to make some of these trees commercially available as a fundraiser to support the nursery and plant trees on campus. And so you'll be hearing more about that. So in addition to our MSU Shadows wood program on one side, we also now be able to offer some of these trees that are original genetic trees from campus, you know, for people who are bleed green and want to have a Spartan oak or a Spartan pipe pine or whatever in their backyard or their front yard. We really encourage them. So we're hoping that we can get some good sales on that as well. So that's our heritage tree program, preserving the original genetic signature of the MSU campus. Crab apples, as I talked about, we have had thanks to Milt Barron and George Parmalee, one of the most extensive collections of crab apples on campus. When I got here and I started talking to people on the design, engineering, and landscape end of things, you know, oh, it's just a crab apple. Oh, it's brush. And I started doing investigation. This is a book, since we're in a library, we got to talk about books, right? Father Phyla, John Phyla, wrote a book, the Bible of crab apples. MSU's collections are extensively referenced in this book. It's incredible, as well as other major collections like at the Morton Arboretum and elsewhere. But the MSU and Hidden Lake Garden, MSU's Hidden Lake Garden, are extensively referenced in this book. What was really sad is that when a crab apple was to be taken out and was next, you know, on a construction bay of a construction project, it's just a crab apple. Cut it down, throw it in the chipper. It's just a crab apple. I said, that's not just a crab apple. That's Malus blah, blah, blah. It's the only one in the collection. It's not commercially available anymore. It's in the book. It's in the Bible. How can you just say it's just a crab apple? Please, stop that. And so working with Paul Schwartz and our designers now, we got, if a tree's in decline, nothing lasts forever. Some of these trees are 50, 60 years old. For a crab apple, that's pretty incredible. Sometimes there's a construction project and we're going to lose them. And if I can't save them by throwing a little bit of a temper tantrum, and I have, then what we do is we collect signwood from the crab apples, and we work with a nurseryman over in South Lyon, Andy Duvall. Andy Duvall grafts those onto rootstock, and we get plants back. Now, this is out of Beaumont Nursery. These we've gotten back from Andy from last year's grafts. We're going to be collecting grafts this month with Pete Murray, who's one of our people that works with us in the garden, sending over a new batch. So anytime we can, we got a onesie, what kind of onesie twosies in the collection. I wish I would have been doing that. You know, I wish I would have come to this realization when I arrived here in 1993, because we lost so many one-of-a-kind crab apples on the campus. And like I said, a lot of these older varieties are no longer commercially available. So always that concern, well, are they disease resistant? Well, you know, if it's been growing on the campus for 50 years and it's still alive and it's in relatively decent shape and it's only starting to decline, I would say it's pretty resistant. So anyway, that's one of our major programs that we've got going on. And then finally, the MSU Shadows program. It used to be that, you know, when a tree came down, you know, we just, you know, took it down to the stump dump. We'd throw it on a pile. We'd grind it up in a big tub grinder. We'd make wood chips out of it. In the good old days, we used to use those wood chips back on campus, so at least we utilized them. While we were still burning coal and everybody was becoming very aware of carbon footprints and biofuels and such, we began to take the wood chips and feed them into the power plant as a substitute with the coal. Since we've converted over to natural gas, now all of a sudden, look at all these logs. Those are logs. It's the guys in the back of the room. We've got logs. Have we got logs? What are we going to do with this stuff? Well, you know, Paul Schwartz and I, for years, you know, looked at this stuff and said, you know, we should be doing something with this stuff. You know, he would take a log or two or three down to the Ag Expo site, and there'd be a guy with a portable mill, and he'd mill some wood out of it, and that wood would go over to the IPF and the carpentry shop, and they would use it for doing cool things. But, you know, finally, after many years, we coordinated with MSU Surplus and the Forestry Department and got a program together where we got a grant, we bought a wood miser. It's a little portable sawmill, there it is. And we have a person, Dan Brown, who we hired. He's a graduate of the forestry department. He works with students, so there's a hands-on learning experience for students. This utilization of urban wood, urban repurposed wood coming from the urban forest and making useful products out of it rather than just grinding it up into wood chips is something that the USDA has been heavily sponsoring and trying to get people excited about. Particularly in light of the Emerald Ash Borer issue, when a lot of urban areas started having to cut down lots and lots of ash trees, what do you do with all the ash wood? There's just so much wood chips and firewood that you can have. And so we realized we had more than just ash trees. You know, we lose trees. We have some beautiful cherry trees, occasional walnut tree comes down, maple, elm, all kinds of really neat wood. And when you cut it up and you make things out of it, it's absolutely beautiful. And if you make things out of it and if you can sell it, we work with local artisans in the community to do the carpentry work. You're making an object that's hopefully going to become an heirloom. It's going to sequester that carbon rather than releasing it back to the atmosphere through decomposition as a wood chip or through combustion in a power plant. Please, if you haven't been down and checked out the collection, I encourage you to do that. The funds go back to help pay students who are doing internships and support them, and the funds will hopefully be coming back once we start getting, you know, like any business, you have a certain startup cost, but start having some of the funds to come back and support the nursery and support planting trees on campus. The small house project that the students did last year, you may have heard about that. We had donated wood to that project. A lot of wood is being utilized in campus buildings. If you want a piece of furniture, okay, and you want it made from a piece of MSU wood, rather than going off to the store or near the catalog or online and buying a piece of furniture, check with us first, because we can make custom pieces of wood. You know that table there, instead of being made out of Formica, you know, you can have that beautiful tree from Professor Beal planted, you know. What a great way to commemorate our trees, rather than just letting them rot or turn into ashes. So very important program. We're very proud of it. And so many people, I mean, everything I've spoken about today, you know, is a huge group of people from the landscape architects to the grounds department folks, the landscape services department folks, Beaumont Nursery, the people who water the trees after they've installed, the people who install the trees, the people who take care of the trees, spray the trees, prune the trees. It doesn't happen on its own. It'd be nice if it did, but it really doesn't. So, but anyway, again, the purpose of the planting of trees on collection, it's not just another pretty place. We want to maintain the diversity of our plant collections, and the main purpose is for teaching, research, and outreach, as well as beauty, okay, and aesthetics. So we try to keep the MSU green. It's a team, and it's a very important team, and I'm proud to be a part of it. So thank you. Any questions? Yeah, question? That's an excellent question, and it's one I think that botanic gardens and university-based gardens and arboretum around the world are trying to wrestle with. One of the key things about climatic change, which those who follow climatic change rather than denying it, follow it closely, realize is that one of the projections which seems to be coming true is it's not so much kind of a uniform warming and, wow, we're going to be a zone 6 and we can zone 7 and soon we'll be able to go palm trees of Michigan State. That's the, wow, isn't that neat? The real issue is an increase in extremes. There's an uncertainty factor. And we experienced one of those very clearly about 2 or 3 years ago when in March we had 80-degree weather. And we had all kinds of flowering trees leafing out and flowering, and we lost an entire apple and cherry crop because then it didn't go that it got all of a sudden it got colder than normal. No, the weather just turned back to normal. And normal in March and early April is still frost. And so it killed back a lot of those plants. So the challenge that we have, we think about, well, maybe we can try planting zone 6 material here as a way of compensating and keeping things going. We had, it's very sad. I had a Sequoia dendron giganteum, which is a zone 6 tree, pardon me. We're technically zone 5 going to 6. I had a cedar of Lebanon, which is should have been zone 5, but marginally zone 5. They were killed not by that event, but they were killed by last year and the year before. Remember how bitterly cold. And that bitter cold, what's unusual about that, we talked about the polar vortex, and that's just that big low center that's normally over the North Pole, just slipped down because of a change in the jet stream and centered over Michigan. The rest of the world had a warmer than average winter. We had a colder than average winter. The problem is when that high pressure center moved down and gave us that cold snap, it was relentless. Normally, we get a cold snap, it'll last a week or two, you know, sub-zero degree temperatures, and then that, you know, it warms up, and maybe you get up, you know, you get a winter, you get a January thaw, the bees come out of the beehives, you know, things are good, and then again, you know, it gets cold again. But you kind of get this flux. It just came and it just sat there. And those trees that were marginally hardy in our collection, they didn't like it a whole lot, and we lost them. So that's the climatic change issue question. Is how do we deal with these extreme events that are going to be happening, and can we deal with those extreme events? You know, I can't sit there and tell the LAs, oh yeah, go ahead and start planting zone 6 and 7 plants because, you know, we may get hit with another one of these winters, and so it's that uncertainty, that high variability, because as you warm up the atmosphere, you change circulation patterns, you add more chaos into the system, so it's an uncertainty factor. Yeah.
We have a history of having American chestnut trees on campus.
Well, American chestnut is not native to Michigan. Okay. It may have been native, or more likely it's thought to have been introduced into the southeast portion of the state coming in from Ohio. Andy Jaros and Dennis Fulbright, who's retired, two of our top researchers in the area of chestnuts, American chestnuts, chestnut blight disease and resistance. We have a chestnut tree on campus that is many decades old. It actually is producing fruit. I don't know if it's ever produced any fertile fruit or not. We have two American chestnuts. One's planted over in Sleepy Hollow. One's planted right outside the window. I can probably point right to it if you want to come over and look at it. Yep, there it is. You can see it right there. Got a commemorative sign on it. Still there. We have about a dozen of the American Chestnut Society or American Chestnut Foundation's hybrids, which are back crossed against a Chinese chestnut to try to get to breed resistance into it. So they're like 97% American chestnut and, you know, 3% Chinese genetically. So they're not, you know, a pure American chestnut per se. So you know, we have chestnuts on South Campus in the research area. Where our researchers are studying them. And unfortunately, what I'm really nervous about is we do have chestnut blight on those trees. They are studying chestnut blight. And if we could keep that chestnut blight away from our nice old chestnut tree that we do have on campus, I'm just kind of keeping my fingers crossed. I'm not overly optimistic, but I'm hopeful. Yeah.
There was a little chestnut tree planted in the Beale Garden area a few years ago. And they had a sign on it with the verse by Robert Frost that the white ape and the chestnut farmer I guess not, and it'll smolder at the roots and send out shoots until some other parasite would come to end the blight. What's the background of that tree, and is it still there?
No. Back in the late 1990s, our collections manager at the time, Elaine Chittenden planted two American chestnuts in the Beale Garden. One was over on the ET slope, or endangered species slope, over towards the IM building. The other was planted just kind of up the slope from the pond. Neither of those two trees survived. And again, I think because we're kind of marginal for chestnut here, it's not in its home range like you are in the Appalachian Mountains, South Carolina, North Carolina, Appalachians going up through Virginia, up through New York State and New Jersey. I remember when I was teaching a summer camp in northern New Jersey, and we would see the we had chestnut trees that were about that big around coming up from the rootstock of the old chestnut trees, and they were producing fruits. The thing that I was taught, and Andy Jaros would correct me if I'm wrong, he's not here, but my understanding is that when the American chestnut starts out, its bark is fairly smooth and contiguous, so that outer periderm layer, it's wonderfully smooth. But when a tree gets older and it starts to expand, it starts to crack, and that when that layer cracks, it kind of allows for the fungus to actually get into the bark. And so the younger trees, as long as their bark is smooth, can be fairly resistant to the fungus. The fungus does not kill the roots. It only kills the upper portion of the tree.
You coat the tree with wax, perhaps, to keep the fungus out?
A part of the problem is that a tree has to breathe through its bark. There is respiration going on with the vascular cambium. Oxygen does diffuse in, carbon dioxide does diffuse out. So if you put an impervious coat on there, then that could be detrimental to the tree. So that's why we don't like people to paint trees on campus either. When we had the rock used to be up here by Beaumont Tower, and then people would get excited and they'd go out there with their extra paint and rub it on the trees, you know. And so one of the reasons the rock's been moved over there is there's nobody, you know, no trees to paint. So.
I love the talk, but of course not.
But not
as many people are here who wanted to come because they've got commitments. Is a lot of this history written down anywhere?
It's a lot of it's in the Beale book. I mean, you know, especially the pre-1915 stuff. We try to have a lot of this stuff in terms of individual trees documented in the database. That's been my objective, is try to get these things into the database so that, you know, it does, you know, persist. One of these days, hopefully, maybe I'll actually write a book, and I'll try to refrain from putting editorial comments in it.
Well, I've noticed that a lot of other Parkland campuses have started writing books on the development of their campuses.
Yeah, and there's been books written about the development of the campus, but I don't think anybody's written a book about the development of the green space. And I think they really, when you look at some of the more recent books, I'm trying to remember who the author was, 1955, College to University is a title. There's a couple other books that have been written. There's Dressel's book, and then there's another one. I think it was more recent than that, but they talk a lot about the people, they talk a lot about the buildings, they talk a lot about the roads. Ron Flynn, who just retired, he was the director of a physical plant, 50 years? How long is Ron in charge there? He just wrote a book. I haven't seen it. I don't know whether he talks much about the green space as much as he probably talks about the actual physical plant of the university.
Yeah, I think it's just come up. He was in here doing the research, looking for second.
Yeah, just got published. So, but again, I think he probably focused more on the buildings and the roads and telecommunications and power plants and things like that, and not so much on the green space. I could be wrong. Peter, you have a copy of the book?
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I have one.
Okay. Yeah. So, anyway, I haven't seen a copy of it yet, but I know obviously he did do one. So,
we are recording today too. So, Dr. Tulewski will be in the Voice Library, okay. Cataloged in the library's online catalog.
Oh God, I'm busted.
Yeah. What was the variety of elm that Roosevelt planted?
I think it was a European variety. It might be Hollandica. It's in the database. That's something everybody kept asking me about. Do you know anything about the Roosevelt elm? The what? the who? You know, and then so I finally started looking, and I found some information. And I actually, once I found out where it was planted, it actually is on our maps. Every tree that was on this campus that we can identify, alive or dead, you know, we keep track of on the maps. And so I put it down on, you know, there's a building on top of it right now, but there's a little dot. And we actually have it in the database, when it was planted, who planted it, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, when it was, you know, when was it moved and when it died. So, I mean, that's in the database now. So if somebody wants to look that up, they can find it.
And you also mentioned that you have records, mm-hmm. all the records. Are those publicly accessible records, or are they in-house only records?
They're in-house records only because, you know, unless there's somebody who I really could kind of trust to go through them, you talk about archive maintenance. I mean, we haven't cataloged them. Literally, when the nursery was being refurbished, a bunch of boxes with some partially once upon a time maybe exposed to moisture, wrinkly papers showed up on my doorstep. We've got maps that you know have all kinds of stuff on them, including measurements of diameter data that should all be entered in the database. There's 3x5 file cards. There's a lot of this data that I don't want to let go because we're trying to get it entered. We were successful at getting a plant recorder's position. Carolyn Miller here is our plant recorder. I requested the person be a permanent full-time position. We have her for 3 years. I am going to be lobbying that position be extended and maintained as a full-time permanent position because one of my objectives for having hired the plant recorder was to get that data off the paper and into a database that then is searchable and then is publicly available. So, Carolyn, how much data have you had time to work on that's archival?
Not much.
And why is that?
You're catching up on everything else.
So we used to, all of this mapping, all of this inventory stuff, all of this database stuff, I was doing, Pete Murray was doing, Pat Hesch was working on, and we worked on it in the wintertime, when I wasn't teaching, when they weren't working in the garden. And so you'd be working on it for 2 or 3 months, and you have to drop everything and go do your regular job. And then you come back and say, where were we? What needs to be done? And some other crises came along, and you're trying to catch up with it. And really having a full-time person be able to help us with that, do that part of the job is so critical to a collection. And when I first came here, it's kind of ironic. And yes, we're being recorded, and I don't care because it's one of my editorial comments. Get over it. When I came here, I was told flat out, no, we're not going to sit there and inventory every tree on campus. But by the way, you need to know what the diversity of the collection is and make recommendations on what we have and what we don't have. Wait a second. How do I know what we have and we don't have? We don't know what we have and we don't have. Okay. Yeah, so I went out by myself and I just started doing the inventory myself and mapping it. They told I learned how to use AutoCAD. Then we finally got a database, BG base. We were able to take all these different databases that everybody had for plant records. We unified it into one database. So now at least you could find stuff and know what was there and trying to minimize discrepancies and incorrect data. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, you have all the trees on campus mapped? Well, that's going to really help us, with the tree crew. Anytime now, because the way IPF is working more efficiently in landscape services in terms of tracking costs, if you can actually pin a cost to a specific tree in a database with a number to it in a specific location and track that and bill that to a certain, because there's different accounts and everything they get billed on, your efficiency goes up immensely. So all of a sudden, what I put together, if you build it, they will want it. And that's a great thing. And that was exactly my intent. Because I can go across campus and I can say, well, do we have one of those in the collection? Well, no, we don't. Well, let's get one. But 20 years ago, I had no idea what we had. And so, we have a post oak, which we saved when we were doing the restoration, when we were doing the reworking here at the Beale entrance. I had no idea we had a post oak on campus. There was no record we had a post oak. And here's a post oak, a bloody post oak. It's not supposed to be growing here. It's not supposed to be hardy here. Beautiful tree. Oh, we're going to cut it down because we need to widen the road. No, you will not cut down that post oak over my dead body.
When you're documenting the commemorative trees, are you putting in photographic
yes.
information?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we're hoping to make this available and searchable on an online, so if somebody wants to look up a specific tree, hey, what's that tree in front of Breslin Center? Well, just click on the map, you know, or, you know, how, you know, where's mom's commemorative tree, or where's grandpa's commemorative tree, or whatever. And, you know, with pictures on there, too, you can kind of see what it looks like when it was planted. There'll be update pictures. So we have a lot of that data. I mean, most of that data is in a map and on a database. It's just getting it so that we have it accessible online.
I have this picture of MSU campus back in the 1930s. And it's got a picture of all the buildings that were on campus back then. And in front of Jenison Fieldhouse is all the elms that they planted. Mm. A lot of people don't realize that how big those elms from from the 1930s till now, how big they are, how fast growing elms were.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, elm, when you guys have to cut one down, you look at the growth rings in there. I mean, you could have an inch worth of growth depending on the conditions that tree's growing in, ideal conditions. So yeah, so some trees can grow pretty quickly. That's, you know, that's a good thing. But yeah, no, that's great, and that's why all these photographic evidence, all these archival stuff that we have, trying to piece together the story of MSU. I've been doing it for 25 years, and I still don't have it. But it's opportunities like this to put together a talk. Okay, you know, I'm going to dust Beal's book off again. I'm going to look something up. I'm going to take a walk over to archives because that's a question I'd like to have an answer. And, you know, it kind of forces me to put this stuff into some semblance of a presentation. So I really would, and I told Jeff Kekos before he retired, says, you know, yeah, I would like to write a book one of these days. But, you know, between teaching and research and graduate students and databases and managing staff and trying to keep people from cutting trees down on campus, not a lot of free time. But okay, thank you very much for coming, folks.
Thank you. Okay.